Hello, everyone. My name is Darsha. Welcome to Heartseed Sisters Podcasts. Note that Heartseed serves as a fountainhead for transforming communities by supplying a wealth of ideas and resources for heart-minded reconstruction of living on the earth. Today, I'm speaking as Primal Protector on the topic of raising children with love or dynamite. Subtitled, With the Evolved Nest, We Become Human. Without it, we are fearful reptiles. Do you know any vicious people? People who are routinely self-centered, cruel, domineering, exclusionary. I'm not talking about your mother-in-law, your brother-in-law, or anybody in particular, but I'm talking about people who are soulless, mindless, heartless. They tend to spend their lives grasping for power over control over others. Some withdraw from the world with self-medications like consumerism. Do you have a closet full of unopened book packages? Oops, I guess that's me. You get carried away and obsess about physical pleasures like, let's say, a box of chocolates? Or maybe you binge on media or drugs? Or intellectual pursuits? Oops, that's me again. Why are there so many people in the United States lost in the seas of anger or self-pleasuring or withdrawal, isolation? Here is my hypothesis that I'll talk about today. The United States is one of the worst places in the world to raise a child. There, I said it. Don't throw your tomatoes at me or your dentures. Children know what I mean. Childhood here is one frustration after another. How can this be true in the monetarily richest nation on the planet? How can it be the worst place to raise children? Of course, life is more than about money or chocolate. The United States undermines the provision of what young children need at virtually every step of the way. It's like the child's path is cursed from birth, like Oedipus or Sleeping Beauty. But those are myths, stories. I'm talking about reality. And reality is something we can change. It doesn't have to be this way. So what do I mean when I say that children have the deck stacked against them in the United States? Well, to understand this very bold statement, we have to examine or understand what children need. What do they need to develop properly as a human being with all their capacities? Well, like every animal, they need a nest. And a nest has evolved for every animal. As ethological observations of many animal species have noted, all animals provide a nest that matches up with the maturational schedule of the young. This optimizes, then, the development of the young. Humans aren't any different. Humans evolved a particular nest to provide a very intensive type of care because we're so immature at birth. We're born much more immature than any other hominid. And depending on what you're looking at, we should be in the womb another 9 to 18 months. Ooh, don't tell the moms. As a result, most of our brain develops after birth. And it matters then what experiences you have as to how well that brain develops. Humans evolved a particular type of care, experience expected care in early life so that those systems, stress response, neurotransmitters, endocrine systems, all develop properly. So for a normal, healthy human being, an intense level of support is supposed to be provided by the mother and the community, not one or the other, both together. And throughout most of humanity's existence, this has happened. And it's only in the last, 1% of our existence, the last 10,000 years or so, that we've undermined this nest, systematically, culturally trumping biology, and then rationalized it all. And I could talk on and on about all that, but we're going to focus on the nest today. What do we know about humanity's evolved nest? How do we know that there is such a thing, right? Well, we can use the research that anthropologists have gathered from all over the world from nomadic foraging communities. Nomadic foraging communities are the type of society that represents humanity's 99%. 99% of our history was spent in nomadic foraging communities. This means nomadic foragers don't have possessions to speak of. They don't have property. They have nothing to fight over. They don't domesticate animals. They don't cultivate plants. They don't hoard resources. They're migratory, and they move from location to location based on seasons and food supply. And they're in small groups. And wherever they've been studied, they provide the same kind of child-raising practices. And these have been summarized. The book, Hunter-Gatherer Childhoods, edited by Barry Hewlett and Michael Lamb, summarizes these characteristics. Melvin Connor also has a chapter in there that identifies them. He calls them the hunter-gatherer childhood model and noted, these have been around for a very long time. Maybe they're important. What are these characteristics? I'm going to quote now. Young children in foraging cultures are nursed frequently, held, touched, or kept near others almost constantly, frequently cared for by individuals other than their mothers, fathers and grandmothers in particular, though seldom by older siblings. They experience prompt responses to their fusses and cries and enjoy multi-age playgroups in early childhood. To this list of characteristics, we can add two more, which are also observed in these communities, but just were not listed. They are soothing perinatal experiences and positive social support. Really, you're saying? You got to be kidding, right? Nope, not kidding. These are the characteristics that make a human being. How much do they matter? They really, really matter. Great deal. We've got lots more evidence now, neuroscientific evidence, animal studies evidence, because a lot of these characteristics are shared with social mammals. And we know that when they're not provided, and you can do experiments with that, the animal doesn't develop properly. Their systems get thrown off in their development. And humans are so much more sensitive to early care than these other animals. We're so much more social. We're so much more malleable in early life compared to other animals. So the nest really, really matters for humans. But remember now, think back on the studies you have heard about, and I think everyone knows Harry Harlow's studies. When animals don't get that evolved nest that's specific to their species, they don't turn into a normal representative of their species. So think about Harry Harlow's monkeys. Now, he didn't intend at first to provide a species atypical nest or environment to the young monkeys, but that's what he was doing. John Bowlby and others probably came by and said, hey, that monkey shouldn't be isolated in a cage. That's not normal for a monkey. Well, then Harry Harlow decided to start doing experiments to manipulate that early experience. And so he talks about the deprivation of maternal love. So he kept them away from their mothers. Mothers would normally be holding and comforting them. Lots of physical touch. They didn't get that. They turned into autistic, antisocial, violent creatures. They couldn't get along. For a social species like a monkey, or for social species like a human being, that's pretty drastic. But maybe you think, oh, that's monkeys. That's not us. All right, here's another example. Perhaps this is better. Think about raising a wolf in a human family. You're going to end up with a wolf, right? The wolf's not going to learn to talk. The wolf's not going to learn to walk on two legs, right? Because the wolf isn't plastic enough to learn that stuff after birth. But think now of when you raise a human in a wolf's family, and this actually has happened a number of times around the world, you end up with a wolf child. The individual raised by wolves walks on all fours. They know wolf howls. They don't know how to talk, although they could probably learn some things. But they never recover language skills, social skills. Walking like a human being just seems very awkward. So there are really sensitive periods for the development of various characteristics, and there's thousands of them, millions of them probably, layered up over those first months and years of life. So I argue, here and elsewhere, that one of the most important evolutionary inheritances that humans have is the evolved nest. Why is that? Because human physiology and psychology are highly shaped by postnatal experience, more so than for any other hominid. We are vastly shaped by that kind of care we get after birth. Neurobiological systems of all sorts that are important for all that a human becomes are shaped at that time. And this includes the development of sociality and morality. Those are things that are specifically of interest to me, and well-being. And we'll talk another time about Darwin's moral sense. Darwin identified the moral sense as a set of characteristics that you can see in the tree of life, that here and there they're shared with other animals, but in humans they all come together and they reach their apex in humanity. And he sounded like maybe he thought it was inherited, that it just came about, but it looks like it's actually epigenetic, not genetic, meaning that it has to be shaped after birth, because we have so many people that are missing pieces of the moral sense now, in part because they're missing this nest, which I'm going to talk about. But we're going to talk about the moral sense another time. So here are just a few of the indicators of how the United States undermines the evolved nest. Pregnancy. It's important for moms to avoid stress and distress during pregnancy, as we know now from multiple studies that they influence the personality and well-being of the child, of that fetus. For example, stressed moms create more irritable babies, which means it's harder to care for them, harder to be responsive to a baby that's so irritable. But in the United States, there's little expectation anymore that mothers should be calm and resting during pregnancy. And they're expected to work right up to birth, and even to return to work shortly after birth. Do you remember in the 50s? I remember from watching old shows, the mothers who were pregnant, you know, they had a glow about them. They beamed as a pregnant woman. These are well-cared-for women, of course, but I hardly ever see that anymore. So imagine then that instead of resonating with their baby during pregnancy, after birth, getting their bodies in tune with one another, the mother tuning up the baby systems, instead we have moms who are distracted, stressed, thinking about other things during pregnancy, and then they're absent during the most important times for brain development after birth because they have to go back to work. Childbirth. Medicalized birth in the U.S. is a clear and present danger for normal mothers, mothers without risk factors. But our hospitalized birth practices at every step tend to traumatize the mother and baby. Now, we have baby-friendly hospitals coming into play now that minimize some of that, but they're still oriented to preventing great tragedies and treat everything fearfully, which kind of undermines birth, right? Because you have to be relaxed to give birth. You have to be able to let go and go with your animal instincts and move around and go with that energy that's coming through you as the baby is born. Hospitals are not set up to do that. And so they tend to try to shape and control moms and babies. And through that, they induce pain. They provide sensory shocks to that infant with the bright lights and smells and harsh treatment. And then they're undermining that normal mother-child bonding, entrainment, and the child's introduction to the world. So this is not a soothing place to be born. Post-birth experience. A child's proper development depends on bonding with mother and that continued entrainment body to body with the mom's physiology. The child needs that external womb experiences for proper development for a number of months after birth. And that infant learns how to self-regulate, self-control from the calming care they receive, the affectionate, loving care. If you leave a baby to cry, they're not going to learn that. They're going to learn how to go into paralysis or rage, but they're not learning how to, they're not building their vagus nerve, for example, which affects all the major systems of the body, if you're not providing that calming care. Stephen Porges' work has looked at this. The United States is the only advanced nation and one of the very few in the whole world that doesn't have paid maternal leave after birth. And put this together with an expectation that women should work, every woman should work, mother should work, and that there's no child care at work, no support, well, it's going to undermine the evolutionary design mother-child relationship. Babies are unlikely to receive that caring, responsive care, in-arms care that they need if they're sent to daycare. So then they're going to become more distrustful of the world from the denial of their needs, from the denial of their mother's mothering. And that leads to adults with all sorts of various problems, because distrust is just a signal of other things. And worse, or just as bad or equally of concern, is that the United States is the only advanced nation where the practice of infant circumcision is widespread and condoned by medical professionals, despite its great harm. We'll talk about that another time. But I've written blogs about this with experts. Think about if you're going up to a party, you've never been to this house before, and you can't wait to, you know, meet new people and friends and your old friends, maybe, and you open the door, and it's a blast of horrible sound, noise, smell, just horridly traumatic. When you open that door, you're going to want to shut the door and withdraw, right, and not go in there. But that's, in effect, what we do to a baby when we traumatize them at birth. We're suddenly they're here, and then, a rush of pain and horror floods all their senses. Well, what do you think that's going to do? What kind of impression of life is that is going to be left in that child's body? One of lack of safety, right? It's not a good place to be. Go hide away, or else throw grenades. So you're either going to withdraw, and your systems are going to just shut down that way, or you're going to rage to fight it off, right? So it's that withdrawal. It's opposition or withdrawal. Opposition, withdrawal, and you flip between those. And then that becomes relevant to your morality, which we'll talk about another time. Breastfeeding. Only about 15% of U.S. hospitals are baby-friendly, which means really breastfeeding-friendly, because they don't address circumcision. They don't address other aspects of being baby-friendly. But they do address not separating mom and baby, and they emphasize not giving infant formula or sugar water to babies, which a lot of hospitals do, which undermines then your immune system development, since most of your immune system's in your gut, and formula and sugar water are going to feed the bad bacteria instead of the good. The rates of exclusive breastfeeding among mothers in the USA at 6 months are pretty low. And breastfeeding, the USA pediatricians, American Academy of Pediatrics, emphasize 1 year of breastfeeding for babies because they don't think moms can do it any longer or will do it any longer. Well, in our heritage, it's breastfeeding should last till about 4 or 5 years of age. I know it's like a shocker, isn't it? But this is what is necessary for the immune system to develop to adult levels. It doesn't happen till about age 5, and breast milk has all the immunoglobulins you need to develop the immune system, plus thousands of ingredients that are developing the brain and everything else. So when we don't provide children with years of breastfeeding, and I know this is a really hard thing to swallow, we're really not providing the human typical or species typical nest. Affection and responsiveness. Babies expect to be held and carried virtually all the time. You remember, they're supposed to be in the womb another 18 months. So that's what they expect. They feel pain when it doesn't happen, and they let you know. Under normal, naturalistic birth conditions, mom doesn't want to put the baby down. She and the baby really become like magnetized, right, to one another. The reward centers in their brains are just lit up and bonded, or, you know, mind melded, body melded in those first hours or two. But as we said earlier, a lot of hospital practices are not providing the support needed for that bonding and entrainment. Worse, even if the hospital provides skin-to-skin touching after birth and supports mom and baby's entrainment and bonding, etc., when the mom goes home, she may face family members, friends, acquaintances, co-workers who say, "What? You're still breastfeeding that baby? What? You're sleeping next to that baby? You're what?" And they're told, "Oh, you can't let the baby, you're going to spoil the baby if you do that." Or, "Don't let the baby control you. You want to get your life back." All those kinds of messages, and I hear from parents all the time about these things, are going to undermine that mother's instincts to be with that child, to be giving the child what it expects and needs. A mother really has to have great resolve and great support to shut out these mistaken and harsh words of advice. Three more things. Multiple adult responsive caregivers. Babies need constant in-arm support, right? We said that already. But of course, you can't do that. Mom can't do this by herself. It's crazy. In fact, just isolating moms and babies in their own homes is a strange health undermining practice. It's a recent thing. We used to live in extended families all the time, but even before that, in our prehistory, mothers were always mothering with other mothers who shared care, even breastfeeding when necessary. And what multiple responsive caregivers do then is they provide that calming care. They have to be adults typically because they pick up on the attunement to the baby more easily than an older sibling, for example. And babies should be kept calm while their physiological systems are setting the parameters, thresholds for functioning. So you don't want babies screaming because there you've set the parameter, right? Oh, scream is part of my repertoire now, to scream really high. But if you never let the baby scream, that they only have to go, and the mother, father, or grandmother picks up on what they want, provides what they want, the baby will never go into screaming and whining and tantruming. Terrible twos tantruming is a rare thing around the world in these traditional communities. They don't even know what it means. So we know from multiple studies now that a frequently distressed baby is going to develop stress reactivity. That means a low threshold for getting upset. So they'll more easily fly off the handle, which then they're going to carry forward into their personality, into the rest of life. So in the United States, we've undermined the capacity for extended family life for multiple adult responsive caregivers. We expect everyone to be working all the time instead of having leisure to take care of your family members, to build the trust and the sense of community in children from the beginning. Play is another characteristic of the nest. All mammals, other mammals too, like birds, but all mammals play. And it's a sign of health and sense of safety when young mammals start to play. So you should expect children to play. And if they're not playing, something's wrong. Babies expect to play from birth too. And that banter, the back and forth kind of banter, is something that babies can do. Adults do it too, right? Sometimes it's called gossip, a more verbal kind of form of play. But it characterizes our relationship in our ancestral conditions. In small band hunter-gatherer communities, most of life was spent in social leisure. There's minimal work done for food gathering. They didn't eat that much, and they didn't have to work very hard at it. But their social leisure included song, dance, storytelling, teasing. One more characteristic. That's positive social support. The child in an extended family typically finds one or more relatives that love him or her. In some studies, they've suggested that having three people in love with you is ideal for a child. Now, this is in Western contexts. But in Western contexts, we often have nuclear families or even single-parent households. Nuclear family, mom and dad, child. Single households, one parent with children. And the United States actually encourages this single-parent household with the welfare system. So that's an issue. And then when children are sent to daycare or preschool or even regular school, they're isolated with the same age group, same age peers. And this is counter to naturalistic pedagogy. Until recently, it was normal to learn from older people. The older kids love to teach the younger kids, and the younger kids love to learn from the older kids. So what we've done now is we've got this abnormal same-age lifestyle that actually encourages competition rather than cooperation, encourages risk-taking rather than wisdom. And it undermines then the cohesion and the cooperation of the social, the whole society, really. Finally, let me say there are differences, gender differences. Boys need a more extended nest since they are the more delicate sex in virtually any way that's been measured. I'll podcast about this separately, but see my blog called Be Worried About Boys, Especially Baby Boys. So let me just finalize now, conclude that what the consequences are of this abandoned nest. Just like a species-typical nest is necessary to foster a regular individual in any species, whether monkey, elephant, or whale, the evolved nest is fundamental to becoming human. Now, maybe you're interested in turning your child into a monkey, and you might think that's your prerogative, right? But I'm of the view that every child is the community's child. Each child forms the fabric of who we are as human beings, as a human community. And misraised children tear at the fabric of our community. They have a hard time getting along with others, right? They are oppositional. They are withdrawn. So we don't want monkey children, wolf children, and no reptile children. If you are misraised, you're going to think it's logical that, you know, this is not my place. This is not my world. I'm not comfortable here. I was rejected. You don't think this consciously, but I was rejected from this place, and so it's alien. There's some other place better, so let's escape. Let's get out of here. We're only here temporarily. And you dream of heaven or other places off the earth. Why would you want to stay here otherwise, right? So in order not to commit suicide, really, you almost have to feel like, oh, I'm going to get a reward later, right? And you dream of this, whatever that place is, someplace that will feel safe, like hopefully the womb was. And you're going to feel, you know, constricted by any requirements that don't come naturally to you. And you'll lash out against anything that seems onerous. You're not the boss of me, right? So when you don't provide the nest, you're teaching a child to deny himself, to distrust the world, to deny respect for others, for the world, for the natural world in particular. It takes a great deal of insight and healing to repair that toxic damage. And meanwhile, the world, social and physical world, is going to explode then with walls going up or armaments against others. In contrast, species-typical animals learn their place in the bio-community and learn to live cooperatively with others. And that's where we want to go. And that's what we'll talk about later. Thanks.